In the light of news reports of a possible ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, what role can the more moderate Arab states play to create peace in the Middle East? How does their view differ from existing plans, and why have we heard so little from them? Here to talk about the successes and failures of centrist Arab nations is Marwan Muasher, who has served as the Jordanian ambassador to Israel and to the United States. He has also been Jordan's foreign minister and its deputy prime minister in charge of reform. And he's written a book published by Yale University Press called The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation. I'm delighted that it brings Marwan Muasher to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do any particular countries or groups comprise the Arab Center of your title?
Yes. On the peace process, I maintain that the core Arab Center is comprised of Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. And in fact, most, if not all, of the initiatives to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict peacefully in this decade has come from the Arab Center.
But it's interesting that those three states are the ones I would have thought Lebanon would have been part of the Arab Center, although I guess they're not a major player. But Saudi Arabia seems to be a very different society than Jordan.
That is why I emphasized the issue of peace, because if you look at other issues such as cultural diversity or reform, then the center changes. And in fact, one of the main points that the book makes is that the center has only been a center on peace and has not been a center on other issues of concern to Arabs, and therefore, because it has been one-dimensional, is losing its credibility.
And that's why a country like Egypt, which has a rather repressive regime, still can be seen as a center, because they are in the middle of brokering this peace agreement or a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
Yes, the argument that I'm trying to make is that there has been a core Arab center on the peace process and has done valiant efforts to solve the conflict. As I mentioned before, we can go into the details of all the initiatives that we have put on the table. But it is not a center on reform. And in fact, it is difficult to maybe define an Arab center on reform in a consistent manner.
But if we were to go through all of the different Arab countries, would you say that the Arab center is a majority position?
No. In fact, what I would say is that the center today is very much on the defensive. It has chosen to focus only on peace. It has not been able to solve peace despite its valiant efforts, and therefore it has nothing to show for its efforts. And now people are flocking to the only other alternative that they have in the Arab world, which are religious parties who are also not promising delivery on peace, but at least are promising cleaner government, and therefore find resonance among large groups of Arab society.
So this peace process has taken so long and run into so many roadblocks that people's positions have, if anything, hardened over time?
Yes, they became frustrated. We have promised, and I consider, of course, myself part of the Arab moderates. We have promised peace to the Arab society. We have tried. We have put on the table an Arab peace initiative that commits all Arab states to a collective peace treaty with Israel, security guarantees, an end to the conflict. We have been very instrumental in developing the Middle East roadmap, which is sort of a plan to bring us to the end of the occupation and a two-state solution. But despite all these efforts, they have not materialized in any result. And therefore, Arab society looks at the center and says, why should we believe you? You have only focused on the peace process and did not deliver. You have not addressed issues of reform or good governance or cultural diversity. Then why should we believe you?
Well, does the Arab-Israeli conflict have to be resolved before other regional concerns can be addressed? Like
no.
Economic reform, improving the lives of women, democratic initiatives?
No. In fact, my argument is that they have to go together. My argument is that we cannot wait until the Arab-Israeli conflict is resolved before we look at other issues such as women empowerment or good governance or some of the other issues. At the same time, I also make the argument that unless the Arab-Israeli conflict is resolved, the credibility of the Arab Center is going to be in question.
Well, you mentioned the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002. There are major problems with it, aren't there, for Israel, the right of return?
I don't think so. I think the Arab Initiative offered Israel, probably for the first time, four major components that Arabs have never talked about before. One, a collective peace treaty, not with Arab states neighboring Israel, but with all the 22 Arab states of the Arab world. It promised Israel collective security guarantees so that the security of Israelis is not guaranteed just by the Palestinians, but by the whole Arab world. It promised Israel an end to the conflict, which means no further claims once a Palestinian state is established, so no one is claiming any land of pre-48 Palestine. And the fourth component is exactly the refugee problem. It offered Israel an agreed solution to the refugee problem. And the word agreed is key here, because what Arabs were signaling was that they are not thinking of or claiming to send back 4 or 5 million Palestinians back into Israel. And ironically, it is on this point that Israel sort of did not take the initiative seriously, when to Arabs it has been the major concession that they have given.
So why do you think Israel didn't take it seriously in your estimation? I mean, you were the ambassador to Israel, so I'm sure you've discussed these things in great detail with a number of different Israeli governments.
Absolutely. I think that the position of the Sharon government at the time of the Arab Peace Initiative has been a very hardline position, and I think that they have not given the Arab Peace Initiative what it deserves. I think that Israel today faces a huge problem that it frankly is refusing to acknowledge, which is the demographic problem. Rabin acknowledged it 10 years ago. In a few years' time, the number of Arabs will outnumber the number of Jews, and unless you bring about a two-state solution, Israel is going to be in a very precarious position where it is ruling, a minority would be ruling over the majority. Sharon and Olmert belatedly came to this realization and started talking about a Palestinian state at the beginning of the decade, but I do not think that they are yet at the point to understand the full implications of the Arab Peace Initiative. At the same time, I would also say that the Arabs have not marketed this peace initiative effectively. We have not done a good job in reaching out to Israeli society and explaining what exactly the Arab initiative entails.
Why didn't the withdrawal from Gaza by the Sharon government resonate better with the Arab countries?
Because it was not done as part of a comprehensive package that would end with the end of the occupation.
It was just a unilateral act.
It was, and frankly, it was to serve an Israeli need, not to serve a Palestinian need. Gaza presented a huge, again, demographic problem for Israel as well as a security one. And by withdrawing from Gaza, Israel felt that it would rid itself of this huge problem. It did not do so with the intent of following it up with a solution that would be comprehensive on all parts of the West Bank and Gaza. This was precisely our point. The initiative that we presented in Beirut would solve the problem comprehensively, and not just between Israel and the Palestinians, but between Israel and each Arab state.
My guest is Marwan Mourasheh, who's written a book called The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation, published by Yale University Press. It seems that whenever things look a little promising, then something happens, a terrorist act especially, and then the lines harden again. When the terrorist act is by an Arab, why haven't the moderate Arabs taken a stronger stand against that?
We, in fact, have. I can point, and the book points out, to the fact that we in Jordan, as well as some other Arab states, took a very clear, unambiguous position against suicide bombings. We've stated that they are wrong from both a moral and a political point of view. They have hurt the Palestinian cause a great deal. They have not resulted in any sympathy for the Palestinians. It is plain wrong to kill civilians. And this is something that we made absolutely clear. Of course, we have among Arabs radical elements who do not subscribe to this. And that's one of the main differences between us and them. We believe in a peaceful solution to the conflict. They believe in a violent solution.
And I want to talk about the three elements that you separate the Arab population into. But you were the ambassador to Israel and had attended a major rally on the night that Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by a Jewish radical. Do you see that as one of the turning points in the peace process?
I do. I think Rabin came to realize that a two-state solution is not just in the Palestinians' interest, but also in Israel's interest. And I remember vividly that night when he was visibly buoyed by the reaction that he saw from about 250,000. His policies were, of course, denounced by the Israeli right for a long time. And to see 250,000 sing for peace, come for peace, was truly a very uplifting moment. I don't think that the peace process really recovered, both from Rabin's assassination and the death of King Hussein. Both really worked very hard for peace, and to this day, we don't have visionaries of their stature to carry the process forward.
Did you understand just how important that assassination was at the time? I know you arranged for the Crown Prince to come to the funeral.
Yes, I did. It was maybe, you know, difficult right at the time to understand. I certainly understood that it will have grave consequences, but I'm not sure if I would have foretold that the whole peace process would suffer until the present day. We were living in a much more positive age when everybody on both sides felt that peace was possible. And indeed, after we signed a peace treaty with Israel in 94, Jordan, that is, the mood was a very positive one.
Well, obviously things had changed in Jordan because earlier attempts at establishing some kind of a peace process had led to assassinations on the Jordanian side as well.
A long time ago, yeah. In 1951, when King Abdullah I was assassinated. But we, all sides, have moved a long time from there. Both sides started with mutually exclusive dreams, with exclusionist dreams that would negate the existence of the other or of the other's visions and dreams. I think we are past this stage now, and both sides are realizing that there is no military solution to the conflict.
What was your family's reaction when you were sent to Israel as an ambassador?
I come from an Arab Christian family, and my family, as well as the Christian community in Jordan in general, felt that this might be seen by the majority in the country as sort of less loyal to the cause than everybody else. We need to understand the huge psychological divide that exists between the two communities and the leaps of faith that people on the personal as well as on the national level have to take in order to bring peace. And even though I was the spokesman of the Jordanian delegation and had dealt with Israelis for many years before the peace treaty, it was still very difficult for me to accept to go and live there. And it's a leap of faith that took me a while. And I talk about this in some detail in the book.
Because living with people reveals all sorts of things that you cannot know otherwise about them, positive and negative things.
Absolutely. And I've learned a lot from my time in living in Israeli society. Again, the positive and negatives of that society. I do not regret going there at all. In fact, I consider myself one of the few Arabs who probably understand Israeli society more than anybody else.
David Grossman, who's an Israeli political writer and a novelist, told me some years ago, I don't know if he still believes this, that he supported the two-state process solution, and he felt that there would be a terrible period in which there would be quite a few deaths after some agreement was reached, but that in time it was in the best interest of everybody, and eventually things would just settle down and people would recognize that a whole new situation was in place, and we would proceed from there.
I totally agree with him. I think that all the other alternatives to a two-state solution are terrible alternatives for both sides. If Israel does not have a two-state solution, as I said, then it will have to either live with an indefinite occupation, which would be a catastrophe, or accept a one-state solution in which Arab Palestinians will be given the same right, which would really mean the destruction of Israel. So,
well, what was your sense when you were living in Israel? Don't at least half of the Israelis support a two-state solution?
More than half. And I believe today, in fact, that a majority on both sides will support a solution where, you know, a two-state solution, but a viable two-state solution. I strongly believe in that. Fortunately, we do not have to negotiate, in my opinion, the conflict any longer. This conflict has been negotiated and renegotiated four or five times. And today, thanks to frameworks such as the Clinton parameters or the Taba talks or the Arab Peace Initiative or the Geneva document, both sides have actually negotiated the outlines of a framework. We do not need a solution. We need a way to get there. And this is where, for example, I believe the efforts of the United States can be extremely helpful.
Is the United States trusted in the area anymore?
It is certainly trusted by Israel. It has suffered a huge blow to its credibility, frankly, during the Bush administration because principally of the war on Iraq and because of its disengagement for the last 7 years from the peace process. But it's not a matter of trust alone. It's a matter of knowing that only a superpower like the United States can guarantee such a solution.
Well, Bill Clinton tried in the last 6 months of his presidency to effect some kind of solution, and he was kind of ridiculed for seeming almost desperate. Then George Bush, he pulled back, and now in the last year of his administration, we see a similar attempt.
If you look at the successful American interventions by American presidents or administrations regarding the Arab-Israeli conflict, you will see that all of them took place in the first term of their presidency, whether it is George Bush Sr. with the Madrid peace process or President Carter with Camp David. Taking on the Arab-Israeli...
Both of them only had one term anyway.
Yes, but not, I don't think, because of this. To take on the Arab-Israeli conflict in your last 6 months, when you're looked at as a lame duck president, and I'm not talking about any one president, is not a formula for success. I think the Bush administration now is attempting that as well. It disengaged for the last 7 years. It is attempting now to solve the conflict in its last few months, and I predict that they will again fail to do so.
I'm talking with Marwan Muasher, who's held many high-level positions within the government of Jordan, including Deputy Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, Ambassador to the United States, and first Jordanian Ambassador to Israel. He's written a book called The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation. It's published by Yale University Press, and we will continue our conversation after this. On tomorrow's show, we'll be talking about the power of a single book to transform a country's political climate. And we're interested in hearing from you on this matter. Is there a single book you've read that completely changed your own political views? Tell us by leaving a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.
WNYC is supported by Hofstra University's 34th Annual Summer Writing Workshops, a two-week workshop offering writing for children, poetry, fiction, screenwriting, playwriting, and more, beginning July 7th. More information or registration at 516-463-5016. Metropolitan Talent, presenting Art Tatum, Piano Starts Here, a two-man show, One Lives, One Lives On, featuring a live re-performance of Art Tatum's 1949 Los Angeles Shrine Auditorium concert. Tickets at the Apollo Box Office, Ticketmaster.com, or 212-307-7171. The River to River Festival and American Express, free music, art, and dance downtown. Performances include Ulrich Schnaus, Orchestra Baobab, A Place to Bury Strangers, and more. Details, rivertoriverNYC.com.
Rapper Ice-T is set to perform with the Indianapolis Symphony, and it's not the first time two very different genres have found common ground. Today on Soundcheck, a look at the cozy relationship between classical music and hip-hop. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 FM. WNYC. We're back with Marwan Muasher, who's written a book called The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation, published by Yale University Press. You've divided the Arab Muslim world into three categories: violent extremist groups, the militant resistance movement, and the peaceful movement. So who's in each? Not that I can't guess. But, I mean, your point is that you're saying al-Qaeda is not the same as Hamas?
Absolutely. I talk about political Islam and political Islamic forces in the Arab world. And actually in the Muslim world in general, but particularly in the Arab world. And I do group them into three groups, because political Islam in this country is seen as monolithic, but it's not. The first group is the Al-Qaeda group. I call them the exclusionists. These are people at war with the whole world, not just with the Western world. These are people at war with other Muslims as much as they are at war with the Western world. They are not interested in negotiations. They don't believe in compromise. They don't believe in dialogue. They are they employ terrorist means. But this is a very tiny group in Arab or Muslim society. The second group are groups who also advocate violence, but these are groups where their theater of operations is more local. It is in their countries because of the occupation. So I would lump Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in the West Bank and Gaza as part of this group. These are people who have one leg outside the system carrying arms, the other leg inside the system where they recently participated and are part of the parliaments in their respective countries. And then you have the third group, which are Muslim or Islamic, political Islamic groups who have always been peaceful, have never carried arms, have always been part of the political process in their countries. I'm talking about the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan, the Islamic parties in Morocco, and elsewhere in the Arab world. And what I'm saying is that we need to deal with the second group so that it migrates to the third groups, in other words, give up its arms and become totally a political force, while continuing to fight the first group with which no compromise is possible.
But that middle group has often presented itself as incredibly hard line. Hamas again and again says that they will be satisfied with nothing less than the destruction of Israel. Hezbollah has taken similar stances. And doesn't that make any kind of compromise impossible?
I don't think so. If you look at the positions of Hamas, they have been toned down a great deal in the last few years. In fact, the news today about Egypt and agreeing
brokering a
ceasefire between Hamas and Israel proves that Hamas can be, can negotiate, can offer compromises. You will never have this with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda would never agree to any deal or compromise.
The reports also suggest that there's been progress on the Syrian front. Would that suggest that the Syrian government, which up until now has been rather hardline, might also be considering more moderate positions?
Syria has been a participant of the Madrid process just as all Arabs. In other words, they have committed themselves since 1991 to a peaceful resolution to the conflict between them and Israel. Unfortunately, they have not carried through in later years, with sometimes forthcoming positions. So this is very good news also that Syria and Israel are talking, because in the end, only a peaceful solution is one that we can all have.
Isn't one of the problems that within each of these societies we have warring factions? I'm sure that in Syria there is the same kind of debate that there is in Israel and within the Palestinian Authority, and even perhaps within Hamas. Some people saying we should be more moderate, other people saying no, we have to hold the line. And then one of them wins out, and that becomes the policy for the moment.
I believe the real fight in the Middle East today is between the moderates against the radicals, not between, in both societies. And there is a need for the moderates in the Arab camp to join hands with the moderates on the Israeli camp against the radicals in both. But the problem with us moderates in the Arab world is that, as I said before, we have only focused on one issue. We need to regain our credibility by focusing on all issues of concern to Arab society. And when we do that, and hopefully when we are supported on the peace process by the international community and have something to show for our efforts, we can be bolder as far as reform is concerned and be looked at as more credible by Arab society.
Now, you argue that it's in the Arab country's best interest to be politically moderate, but others warn that more open societies will only lead to more Islamic radical activity.
The Islamists, no question, have a head start of 40 or 50 years over everybody else, which is in part really the fault of Arab governments themselves, who have not opened up their systems and who have only had a ruling elite on one hand and the Islamists on the other. And when people have only two options, and when the ruling elite do not have a system of checks and balances to really monitor their performance, then people will increasingly flock to the Islamists as a protest vote.
Almost as a democratizing force, even though they seem to represent repression on another level.
Absolutely. The traditional forces, as you said, argue that if you open up the system, the Islamists will come in. The fact of the matter is, not opening up the system has not weakened the Islamists. In fact, it has strengthened them a great deal. 25 years ago, nobody would have heard of Hezbollah and Hamas. Today, they are major forces in Arab society. And the reform forces today in Arab society are saying, if you don't open up the system, the Islamists come in. But understandably, you need to do it gradually, but also seriously.
But then the Islamists talk about their fears of the license that a more open society would bring. They seem to be very concerned with things like sexual openness, exposed skin, kissing in public.
I think that all forces, Islamists as well as secular in the Arab world, need to commit to two major principles for political activity. One is peaceful means, that is, no one can carry arms and try to pursue their objectives with other than peaceful means. But two, the point that you mentioned, a commitment to political and cultural diversity at all times. So no one uses democracy to come to power once and then deny it to others. No one uses democracy to come to power and then impose their cultural views on the rest of society. We do not want an Iranian-type regime in Arab countries. We want a regime that respects diversity at all times.
My guest is Marwan Mouasher, who's written a book called The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation, published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, when you bring in Iran, you also bring in a whole other dimension to this discussion, because we've been ignoring the differences between Sunni and Shiite. Is that something that has to be considered in when we're talking about an Arab center?
Well, of course, Iran is not an Arab country. And when we talk
But there are Arab, there are Arab Shiites
yes,
in
there
Iraq,
are Arab
for
Shiites,
example.
Of course. I have no problem with, you know, people's religious affiliation, whether they are in the Arab world. You have Sunnis and Shiites, but you have Christians and Muslims. You have Armenians. You have, I mean, it's a very rich mosaic of ethnic and religious communities across the Arab world. I have no problem with people's religious affiliations, so long as everybody has the right to, as I said, voice their views through peaceful means. What is happening in Iraq today is not encouraging because, yes, you have different, you know, political parties, but they are almost all of them are set on confessional lines. And we do not want parties set on confessional lines. Parties need to be more national if indeed you are to have a prosperous future.
What would be necessary to cultivate moderation? Must it be from the top down or the other way around?
Moderation needs to evolve. I think that the experience of the Arab world shows us that just because the ruler wants moderation or wants reform, and in Jordan we have had this experience where really the king has been the initiator of many political reforms, it's not enough. It's not enough for the ruler to want it to happen without looking at other factors at play. You have an entrenched bureaucracy, an entrenched ruling elite, who are very afraid to lose their interests by any reform process and therefore will resist and have resisted reform processes in the past. So we need to understand that this is an evolutionary process, but a process that must happen and a process where Arab moderates need to be more vocal at.
As a Christian, how are you viewed by the more radical Islamists?
It's mixed. Islamists look at my record on peace and they don't like it. They look at my record on reform and they like it. So it's not black and white. And I think that's healthy. We don't view each other in black and white. And I think that, as I've said, as long as both the secularists and the Islamists commit to some general principles that define the rules of the game, they can coexist with each other.
You mentioned earlier that the United States could get involved. What about the West in general? Isn't there a lot of suspicion of almost anything that the West promotes, perhaps because of cultural concerns or maybe the legacy of mistrust that dates back to the time of Western colonialism?
Well, certainly there is suspicion, but that suspicion is not, permanent or does not necessarily to be permanent. If you look at the European Union today, you will see that its image in the Arab world is far more positive than that of the United States. I think that you can have formula where you can have very positive cooperation between the two communities. We, the Arab world and the European Union, have a number of what they call partnership agreements in which both commit to a joint plan of action that also would result in reform in the Arab world. The United States, unfortunately, and particularly in recent years, has lost a lot of credibility, but that is not, as I said, permanent. People still believe in American values. The values of liberty, of freedom, of respect for the individual are all values that are revered in the Arab world. What people have a strong objection to are some American policies in the region, particularly with respect to Iraq and the peace process.
When were you ambassador to the United States?
1997 to 2002.
So you were there for both the Clinton and the early
yes.
Bush administrations. Mm-hmm. Did you find people receptive to what you had to say?
Oh, absolutely. With the Clinton administration, which was particularly in its second term very involved in the peace process, we worked together on many, many initiatives. The Bush administration came with the view that it needs to disengage from the process because the Clinton administration did not succeed at arriving at a solution. So there was a bit of a distance with the Bush administration. We did work on a number of very important initiatives, including the Middle East roadmap. But if you want me to be candid, the real concern of the United States at the time was the war on Iraq. So it gave the Middle East roadmap only lip service.
You were here during the time of the 9/11 attacks, weren't you?
I was on a plane on my way to receive King Abdullah, who was coming to see President Bush. And the plane was in midair, was diverted to Mississippi, where I had to spend 2 days stuck and not being able to go back to Washington.
But you talk about being shocked by those events. Why haven't we and why didn't we hear more from the Arab Center on that matter? Most of the news reports we saw were of people celebrating on the streets of Arab cities.
Well, we saw some what I think isolated celebrations by some Palestinians in the West Bank, frustrated by the occupation. I agree with you. Maybe we did not see, more Arab moderates being very vocal about it. But I would
out of
not,
fear, do you think?
Out of frustration, out of a feeling that their problems have been ignored by the West for a long time. I disagree with this, but I also, understand when people are very frustrated, they don't find it within themselves to empathize as they should.
How does the Arab Center view the upcoming U.S. elections? After all, we have, if we're going to look at the peace process with Israel, both John McCain and Barack Obama have come out as strong advocates of Israel.
Well, in an election year, we've seen this before. I'm not surprised. We've seen U.S. presidential candidates, give a very pro-Israeli view. Today, the special relationship between Israel and the United States is not contested by Arabs and is not seen as a zero-sum game. In other words, working towards a two-state solution is not against the interests of Israel. It is, in fact, for these interests. And this is what we're trying to do. If there is one advice we give, whether it is to President Obama or to President McCain, is one, to take on the Arab-Israeli conflict in their first term, and two, to use the frameworks that have already been available to bring about a quick settlement. Anytime, and you've mentioned this before, anytime you give the process time now, that time is being used by the opponents of peace on both sides who have very successfully and efficiently managed to derail the peace process. Fortunately, we know the outlines of a parameter. I think it takes the political will of the United States to bring about the two parties and bring about a quick end. There is nothing that would support the cause of moderation or maybe help to stop the wave of radicalization that is coming to the region than this.
But I get the feeling that unless something incredible happens, we will continue the practice of what you call kiss but don't tell.
Well, this is why I'm trying to kiss and tell here. I'm trying to be vocal about the need to bring about an end to the conflict.
Kiss and don't tell is when people meet but they don't tell anybody
absolutely.
That they're meeting.
Absolutely.
And we've seen a lot of that. And then when it's revealed and politicians have to apologize.
We have. I think we have to face facts right, in the eye, and we have to call a spade a spade. We are very terrified about the wave of radicalization in the area. That needs to be stopped. That means we need to bring an end to the Arab-Israeli conflict, but it also means that Arab moderates have to take on the cause of reform very seriously.
Marwan Muasher has held many high-level positions within the government of Jordan, including Deputy Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, Ambassador to the United States, and first Jordanian Ambassador to Israel. He's written a book called The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation, published by Yale University Press. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, how much does the theory of intelligent design hold up to scientific scrutiny? Also, a new edition of Herodotus's classic book, The Histories, which chronicled the rise of the Persian Empire and its war with Greek city-states. States of the Union takes a look at Maryland and on Unreported, how a book by Francisco Goldman published in the U.S. had a ripple effect on political conditions in Guatemala. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Stephen Valentino, Veronica Shagiel, Lawrence Holland, and Catherine Ident. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.